Welcome to the Devin Nunes Podcast, breaking through the political noise, separating fact from fiction. Stay up to date by following Devin on Rumble.com to watch the podcast or downloading wherever you listen to podcasts. From the San Joaquin Valley, the breadbasket of the solar system, here's your host, Devin Nunes.
Devin Nunes here. Thanks again for listening. Our audience continues to grow. We're really appreciative of Michael Anton, author of The Stakes, professor at Hillsdale College, former Trump National Security Council. Mike, you were involved. So we're going to spend a lot of time in this segment talking about foreign policy. You were involved. You were there at the beginning. You came in, worked under General Flynn at the National Security Council. I know that didn't last too long. But what's happened in the foreign policy front is something that I can tell you I never expected, but it's been unbelievably successful, the Trump administration. No new wars, finally kind of just calling it like, look, you know, we're not going to fix these places like Afghanistan. We have to rebuild the military. We have to take a new look at it. And look, I would say that, you know, I've spent a lot of time on foreign policy in my time. Really, Donald Trump, when he was first saying these things, I thought, well, he's going to say it, but he's not really going to actually do it. But he did do it. And look, and I think he would have got a lot more done in the over a 4 year if he had another 4 year term, because there's so much that needs to be done, because there's so much waste at the State Department and the Department of Defense. And with the new Biden administration, all the same cats are going to come back in that corrupted the intelligence process and our intelligence agencies in the first place. But let me start with the positives, Mike. Take credit for a little bit and analyze who laid out these plans. How were they implemented for the multiple successes that you all had there?
To me, the biggest positive is beginning the process of getting our China relationship right. And, you know, people say Trump was inconsistent because he'd been a Democrat, he'd been an independent, he'd been a Republican. There's some truth to that. If you go back over 30-year career, you could find Trump expressing lots of different opinions, not all of which match up. However, one point on which he was very consistent since I was a high school kid in the 80s listening to him talk was about how we get exploited by trading partners that foreign companies take advantage. Now, he was talking about different countries in those days because China wasn't that big of an economy in, let's say, 1986 when the Art of the Deal came out. But it grew. But as it grew, his consistent principle, he focused on China as the most serious challenge we face today. And there he shook up and really, I think, helped to shatter, and I hope it stays shattered, this bipartisan consensus that no, China's peaceful rise will be good for the U.S. And if we do business with them, they'll moderate their behavior and become a good member of the international economic club in good standing. And they won't act in bad ways for our national interests. And he said, no, that failed. Maybe that strategy was good at one point and was worth a try, but we've got the evidence, it's in, and it failed. We have got to get serious and get tough. So much so that I hope he has changed the political climate on this enough that even if Biden and all the people around Biden want to go back to business as usual with China, they find that they can't, that the opinion is just has left them behind on that because of Trump. I hope that's the case.
So that's just the trade issue, which you just talked about. China went in and he put tariffs on.
Yeah.
But I also think we can't forget I was a former chair of the trade committee. I still sit on the trade committee as part of the Ways and Means Committee and spent a lot of time on it in my career in office. And when he was talking about NAFTA and it was the biggest disaster, and I just remember thinking when he was campaigning on it, I'm like, well, it's great he's saying all this stuff. He's bringing up a lot of good points. It would be nice to re-engineer it and have a new agreement. But I thought, he's probably, he's just talking. It's really not going to happen. Probably one of the unsung heroes in the Trump administration is his pick for USTR, United States Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer. Yeah. Probably a lot of people on the podcast never heard of him before, but he did a phenomenal job. He spent a 40-year career on trade issues. And he went in and renegotiated NAFTA, which I think nobody thought he could possibly do.
And not just NAFTA, but some other agreements as well. And China, yes, it's trade, but there's a lot of issues with China, intellectual property theft, the massive espionage that they are doing in all levels and sectors of U.S. society, in our companies, in our universities, in our military establishment, defense contractors. You know, there's so many ways Trump got tough. with them, I think that has been extremely, extremely helpful. He was another one of his accomplishments, and I think you won't get credit for, is ironically one of the criticisms of him that you hear most is that he's mean to our allies and he's shaking. In fact, what they really mean is that he criticizes the Europeans over NATO, but they completely leave out the fact all the alliances that he strengthened in Asia and in the Middle East. In part because the administrations, in particular the Obama administration, would keep their distance from certain countries and say, well, you know, we don't like what you're doing here and there, and we have this moral high ground that we're going to take and not talk to you or talk to you less or cooperate with you less. And Trump had a kind of a more kind of realistic, I might even call it a Kissingerian streak, where he'd say, you know what, maybe some of your internal practices aren't what I would want for the United States, but you're over there and we're over here and you have a different situation and I got to look out for the national interest. So I'm happy to talk to, you know, these Middle Eastern allies and strengthen that relationship. And look where it ended up. You know, we're in a better position in the Middle East right now than we've been in decades, in part because of surging U.S. oil and gas production has made us less reliant, so they have less leverage over us, but in part because of the diplomacy to get those alliances back up and functioning. I would say, too, I'm worried on this score, as one of the Biden's first acts was to stop the Keystone pipeline and also restrict production, private production on federal lands, which will only reduce production overall and make us possibly, I think, if I'm right, if I have this figure right in my head, the United States, you know, stopped being a net exporter, became a net importer sometime in the early 70s. But we got our net exporter status back in 2000. Not even under Trump. It was prior to Trump under the Obama administration. But boy, did that sector really accelerate under President Trump. And if we go in this direction we're going now, we could see us lose potentially our net exporter status.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about energy on my podcast over the years. And so it was basically we became a net exporter of energy despite the Obama administration and their rules because of the development in some states like North Dakota, where they had good governments that allowed people to go to their private property and begin to use new technologies to pull oil out of the ground. Going back to the Middle East, though, there's a tremendous success there. That was where Donald Trump went there first. He had the idea he wanted people to pay more of their fair share, not just in NATO, but also in the Middle East. He wanted them to try to get along. He wanted to figure it out. And he decides to go there. And I think you were there at the time, too. Did you go on that big Middle East trip?
I did, yeah.
Yeah. So as you're going, and I know you can't talk about everything that you did, but why there? Why then? What were the goals? Because obviously the achievements were huge between the peace agreements and moving the embassy. But going back to that stage at that time, were those the goals that were on the table?
Well, I think the president, remember, this is May of 2017. So he still had a notion that he could maybe get a peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. But he knew that the way to do it, if you were going to do it, you had to have the Arab allies supporting you. Because one of the things that stood in the way of such a deal over the years is, to be quite honest, a lot of the Arab states will say in public, yeah, there should be a deal. But then in private, they say to the Palestinians, hold out, don't make a deal. We're on your side, right? And you have to get them to the point where they say what they're saying to the Palestinians in private is not that, but rather you need to make a deal and we'll help you out, but this will be good for you. So I wanted to line that up. Unfortunately, the ability to get a deal with the Israelis and Palestinians essentially fell apart after the embassy move, because Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinians, walked away. And the calculation there on the president's side was, I know this will make him mad, but presumably he'll see it's in his interests to talk and he'll come back. And unfortunately, Abbas never saw it in his interest. And I think he hurt himself and his people and his cause tremendously by not talking. But again, you had, from what I understand, reportedly, you had even Democrats saying to the Palestinians in private, American politicians saying to the Palestinians in private, stay away, don't talk to him. We'll be back in power and we'll get you a better deal. You know, they wanted to prosecute Mike Flynn under the Logan Act, which has never been used in the history of the Republic, for listening as Sergei Kislyak brings up sanctions. And yet, you know, calling the Palestinians and telling them not to work with the Trump administration. Oh, that's perfectly fine. I mean, the hypocrisy just astounds when you think about it.
It's tremendous hypocrisy. It's the old saying, unfortunately, in my time in office, I've spent tremendous amount of time in the Middle East, very frustrating process, because I've actually had different types of conversations where our Arab allies will say things like, you know, look, we know the Palestinians, they're never going to make an agreement. And there's disagreement within those Arab states. But I think what's really brought them together was the old saying of the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah.
And the strength that the Iranian regime achieved during the time period of the Obama administration, you could even argue maybe George W. Bush administration, their involvement in Iraq with terrorist groups, all the blood that's on their hand, financing things in Afghanistan with the IEDs. And then, of course, as our good friend Tom Joslin writes at the Long War Journal, he long had speculated that the Iranian regime was behind al-Qaeda and was harboring al-Qaeda. And I'll be damned, you know, that ended up being true. And of course, the conventional wisdom in the bubble, the DC bubble, by all these geniuses that have worked on this all the years say, well, that's idiotic. Al-Qaeda, they're Sunni Arabs, and no way the Iranians would ever help them.
Right.
Well, clearly, not only they were wrong, they even covered that intelligence up. It was part of another scandal that kind of predated the scandal with the FBI, the cover up of by Obama of the al-Qaeda documents from the bin Laden raid, that then once they were finally out showed that, yeah, the Iranians were more than willing to make the enemy of my enemy the friend, and they harbored al-Qaeda. And now, of course, they didn't want the United States to know because it would be a horrible deal. But I think that the Obama administration knew that all along. They did a deal. They gave them billions of dollars. And ultimately what happened here is the Arab states, Saudis and UAE said, whoa, wait a second. We don't like the situation in Israel, but I think we may like these Jewish guys a little better than we like these other guys that are getting a nuclear weapon and going to kill us.
I think all of that is true. And I wouldn't also discount the business side of it, which is just that, you know, this is a region that's been economically in the doldrums for a long time. The only real bright spot for a long time was hydrocarbons, was oil and gas. And then another bright spot emerges, which is the creation, in a sense, of Dubai as a global financial and business hub that serves the region. And suddenly the Arab states are thinking, you know, maybe it isn't all about oil for us. There's other ways we can participate in the global economy. And it became also increasingly clear that, like, you know, linking up with Israel, which has great relations with the U.S. and other countries around the world, is probably better than just sitting here on the sidelines and being holdouts forever, right? And I think that was a big piece that drove the so-called Abraham Accords signed at the White House in September, I think, between Bahrain, the UAE, and the Israelis. Is like, look, we've been kind of sitting here in this holding pattern for 70 years, mad at one another, and then, like, there's a future out there that's pretty bright if we can work together. And increasingly what's going to happen is that the states that are going to be the most isolated by this will be Iran, obviously, and also the Palestinians, although they don't have a state. But the way to get a state would have been to, you know, negotiate a deal, work with them, and with the help of their Arab brethren states. But I think the Arabs are just like, you know what, you guys, if you just want to sit there and sulk forever, you know, we did that with you for 50 years, 70 years, and we're tired of it. So if you actually want to come and join this new thing, call us. But I don't know that anyone's received the call yet. Doesn't sound like it.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what the Biden administration does, because we have the same people who had the losing concepts and ideas for the last, as you said, 50 to 70 years that are all back in power, including many of the ones who were involved in their P-tape truthers. You know, they're the people who framed General Flynn. They peddled the Steele dossier. These are the people that are back in charge. So I'm not expecting big things at all from them. But matter of fact, I think we're going to see a lot of weakness from them, but we'll see. What are your kind of parting thoughts on the characters and cats that are back in the Biden administration? Where do you think they're going to take these? Are they going to change these? They're going to reinstitute the nuclear agreement with Iran? Where do you think they're going to take these?
Well, I think they'll certainly try to reinstitute the nuclear agreement with Iran. And obviously the Iranians, well, at least it seems obvious to me that if you're Iran, you have nothing to lose by talking to the administration led by the vice president of the administration that made the deal in the first place. Also, it'll make the Europeans very happy to reinstitute the Iran deal, because they get to, you know, if they're locked out, you know, the Europeans want to do business with and in Iran. And the only reason they don't is not because of any, if I may say, moral scruple. It's because if the U.S. puts pressure on them and isolates Iran, the Europeans have to choose what's a more important economy to be linked to. And that's not a choice. If, on the other hand, they have an American administration that says it's fine to do business with Iran, the Europeans will be gangbusters to go. This will, however, put pressure on our, you know, remember that the Obama administration did not have very good relations with Israel or Saudi Arabia or Egypt or the Gulf states. All right. So you have to expect those tensions to reemerge if the Biden administration goes in that direction. In one way, though, it may have the unintended but conceivably beneficial effect of driving the Gulf Arab states and the Israelis closer together as they all come to think, well, we can't really count on the Americans as long as they're in this present mood. So we're going to have to cooperate more fully ourselves without involving us and maybe without even talking that much.
I really appreciate it, Mike. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
It's Devin Nunes. We'll catch you next time.
Stay up to date by following Devin Nunes on Rumble.com to watch the podcast or download wherever you listen to podcasts.
Storm clouds been gathering so long, I don't know.
The darkness around us leaves no easy road.
We started wondering if every road dead ends our dreams. It whips the dust up and rains pouring down.
Good people struggling in every hometown.
We started wondering if we even matter at all. We'll take that hard road to happier days. Trial by fire like this.
It's nothing hard work and family can fix.
We've got the power to save it all here in our hands. We'll take that hard road to happier days. Cause we kept our American faith. We're already half the way there. We'll take that hard road to happier days. Cause we've kept our American faith.
Paid for by Devin Nunes Campaign Committee.